Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Let's assume that in all of the universe, you were the first living being to achieve sentience, billions of years ago. At that point, you'd be doing pretty good to invent fire or the wheel. You couldn't come up with science, technology, find a serum for immortality all in one lifetime.
It wasn't necessary. We were born naturally immortal.
It's impossible. Everything dies.
Yes. Now. At first, we were kept in balance by birth rate. Few of us were ever born, less than a handful each year. Then I think the universe decided that to appreciate life, for there to be change and growth, life had to be short. So the generations that followed us grew old, infirm, died. But those of us who were first went on. We discovered the Vorlons and the Shadows when they were infant races and nourished them, helped them and all the other races you call the first ones. In time, most of them died or passed beyond the rim to whatever lies in the darkness between galaxies. We've lived too long, seen too much. To live on as we have is to leave behind joy and love and companionship, because we know it to be transitory of the moment. We know it will turn to ash. Only those whose lives are brief can imagine that love is eternal. You should embrace that remarkable illusion. It may be the greatest gift your race has ever received.
And welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? That clip right there is something I reference in today's talk as we're discussing immortality. And I really wanted the whole clip, and I couldn't find it while we were doing the interview, during the conversation. So afterwards, I found a clip of it, and that was it. That was the Babylon 5 clip about immortality. And I thought it was perfect to start off our conversation tonight. I have Joshua Cutchin with me and Aaron David of Charm the Water. And so we get into the idea of immortality and what it would really mean if we were able to be immortal. What would be the pros and the cons and the implications on mankind as a whole? It's a lot deeper than I think most people realize, because most people realize, you know, they think, oh, I'd love to be immortal, but would you? Really? So we dig into that a bit. Of course, it goes off the reservation as usual, because it is Where Did the Road Go? So I hope you enjoy it. And like I said, I wanted to put that clip at the beginning there just to get the whole thing out there. Also, we have merch. Yes, finally, there are T-shirts up. There's a store link on wheredidtheroadgo.com. And there are three different designs up. And there's T-shirts, sweatshirts, a mug, even an iPhone case. So go check it out. Support the show by picking up some merchandise. I'd really appreciate it, and I appreciate you guys so much already. So without any further ado, here you go. A conversation about immortality. I'm here with Joshua Cutchin and Aaron David, and tonight's topic of discussion is going to be immortality. And all that really implies, because I kind of thought about this earlier this week. George Knapp had posted something about them being able to reverse aging in mice. And his kind of snarky comment on it was something along the lines of, they're totally going to perfect this 2 years after I die. And, and I started thinking about it. And I'm like, you know, we're always searching for immortality. And we think that that's what we want, but is it actually something we want? What are the implications of getting of immortality. I mean, how does that affect who we are and what we are? And I know Aaron immediately had a bunch of thoughts on this. You want to start, Aaron?
Yeah, I think it's a philosophical question at its heart, and it's been stirred up, as you said, by science. But it's interesting. I think we need to first look at, maybe if it's not a misnomer, first, is there anything infinite here at all? I mean, to truly be immortal, to live forever in a finite universe? So would you guys say that that's maybe a little bit of a misnomer? Or
Probably.
But yeah.
Let's say extended lives, like extremely extended lives. Like if we could live for thousands of years, and there, how long did Methuselah live, supposedly?
Yeah, I think 969 years, something like that.
Yeah, and then Yoda was clearly over 1,000.
Actually, Yoda was, I believe, 900 years old when he died, just prior to the Battle of Endor, I think. So. 950? I want to say 950. I'm going to have to go back to Wikipedia here and look.
I always found it fascinating how, like, Anne Rice dealt with some of that with the vampire Lestat. That was one of the things mm-hmm. I really liked about those novels, where he just got to the point where he was just bored with living.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely something we'd be in danger of. I mean, we're so afraid of death because we don't know what it is. And a part of me says, well, if we knew that death wasn't a bad thing, how many people would just kill themselves? You know, well, I'm having a bad day. Screw it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, death.
Yeah, well, it's sort of that Gordon White thing of realizing that you're immortal. You know, he's a big advocate for, you know, for doing whatever you have to do, be it entheogens, be it his go-to jokingly is taking a Ouija board into an abandoned asylum, but figuring out that whatever you are is not going to die when you die, whatever you are goes on. And at that point, you know, you start to look at life as you know, well, what's the worst thing that could happen? I could die. Like, okay, so.
Isn't it interesting that humanity, that's what separates us out from all the other animals, is this seeking. I see that this has been the goal not only of Gordon White type people, but also religion from the beginning. And science with the transhumanists, the section that concentrates on immortality. Isn't that interesting that we're, as humans, are always, I mean, if you put a horse out in a field, it's going to be content just eating every day. But we have this thing, I think St. Augustine called it a restlessness of the human heart.
Hmm.
It's a transcendent urge, so that we know we're finite beings, but we have this urge. Suggests, I mean, this has been a long philosophical thing that most philosophers don't look too kindly on, the notion of immortality. But starting with Aristotle and the Greeks, who really had an aversion to the idea of the infinite, but where, you know, it kind of gets married is with Christianity, Platonism, Christianity, Neoplatonism, this idea, this transcendent urge really gets put into specifics. Am I making sense to anybody?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you definitely are. I mean, to me, it's one of those things. It's almost like the way that mankind, if you, you know, sort of come from a Christian standpoint, is pulled to sin. But, you know, the idea is that, you know, our true nature is to try to endeavor to rise, you know, above that. And in this sense, like we're pulled to want to be immortal, but it's not it's not attainable. Or I mean, here's the thing: like whatever your outlook is, we're not meant to live forever. You know, if they're materialist, well, I mean, we're not meant to live forever. If you're spiritual, we're not meant to live forever anyway. I mean, like, if you believe in reincarnation, not meant to live forever. If you believe in an afterlife, not meant to live forever. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a reason that we all develop this disease called aging.
I think death's purpose is for life, if that makes any sense. But the idea, if there were no death, that life would cease. Soraya, you mentioned the vampires and this sort of fiction always is putting them as perverse, deformed. Their interest in life kind of dies. Their soul dies. So that's interesting. I mean, we think of a life as a story. It has a beginning, middle, and an end, and that we find meaning. So what would happen if the story never ended?
Yeah.
I mean, if you guys had to do the same thing, I think of Nietzsche too, in this doctrine of eternal return, having to do the same thing over and over, making the same decisions. Wouldn't life lose its luster? Isn't it the...
Yeah.
Death itself that fuels us.
There was a great video going around right now of Neil deGrasse Tyson and Larry King talking about, you know, whether or not you want to live forever. And it's like, for me, it's the one most compelling argument that the atheistic establishment has, is that the reason that things matter is because we have a finite amount of time. The reason that things have meaning in our lives is because we are, you know, we put time into something which gives it that extra bit of meaning. So A, it wouldn't make sense to live forever, but B, like, I have a dear friend of mine who's a jerk. I mean, I love the guy to death, but he's a jerk. But I have a dear friend of mine who used that as an argument against something like the concept of heaven. Like, wouldn't it be torture torture, or, you know, everything would turn to ash in some way if you have all this infinite time to do stuff. And of course, my comeback, would be that, you know, I think that's implying that you would place the same weight on things, in all, mm-hmm. in the afterlife that you do in the current life. And also it implies, like, the sense that there's this ego of me trying to improve myself. So I think those are the big flaws in that. But I do agree that it's a very compelling, take, is the fact that, you know, the reason why things matter to us is because we don't have that much time. And if you were to take that away, I think it would really take a lot of the joy out of life. Now, having said that, you know, I could use 200 years instead of, you know,
right.
You know, 70, I can think that. But yeah, I think, you know, if there is some sort of indefinite endpoint for when people die, or even something that's, you know, extended, like an 800 year lifespan, I do think that would sort of, you know, take the shine off the apple a little bit.
Yeah. What your friend said about the argument against heaven, that sort of is the Aristotelian thing. The Aquinas, when he came along, tried to say, Aristotle thought there was no infinity. Like, we had number that, this is really hard to put into words, but Aquinas came along and said, no, it's not to do with number. It's something, the infinite isn't a numbered thing. It's a transcendent perfectness, a divineness. So that, when your friend was arguing that heaven would be, you know, just, I think he's missing Aquinas's point he was making against Aristotle, and that we're not looking at a numbered thing, but something entirely perfected, transcendent, divine, as the infinite. So what comes after the finite? You know, we don't know. So this transhumanist idea that we could attain to the infinite in the material is a little bit absurd to me.
Yeah.
I think Soraya, you put it well when you said the best we could hope for is extension. In the Bible, guys, you know, there's one argument against that they were counting months and not years. So Methuselah, if they were counting months, Methuselah would have lived to 78 years old.
Interesting.
I'm not too sure about that.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I'm going to crib from, you know, Uncle Gordy again. But the entire transhumanist movement is predicated on a false understanding of what reality is. And it's a false understanding of... It's a false understanding of the way that... It reminds me of that great line from The Force Awakens. That's not how the Force works. Like, this is not how this is not how immortality works. I mean, what they're going after is something that, if it is to be believed, spiritual masters of a ton of different disciplines have already, you know, got it down pat. You hear these stories about, Eastern mystics who scoff at the idea of immortality. Like, no. No such thing as immortality. The oldest I've heard somebody living is, 800 years. but, if you look at sort of the, that's one part of the equation. But, of course, the other part of the equation is to get there, you have to live a pretty austere lifestyle. I mean, I don't know if I get to live to 800 years and not eat a cheeseburger, I don't know if I want to do that or not. it's predicated on this idea that, like, that our brains are ones and zeros. And I don't think that is the working model at all. I mean, I would argue that that interpretation in a world where Daryl Bim and Dean Radin and Rupert Sheldrake, in a world where those people are published, I would argue that that outlook is almost unscientific. Like, you're not looking at the data and really following through on it.
It was interesting. Did you hear Dean Radin's thing on the flying psychic robots?
I just heard that.
I have not. Enlighten us.
I don't even know if I could rehash the depth of that conversation. But the idea is the guys in Silicon Valley are hoping to develop software to download or upload their consciousness into. And that the whole, it's very fascinating, but what came up was ITC, instrumental transcommunication, and how that is already sort of happening. I have personal experience with the spirit box, and that's one of my favorite things. So that you're looking at consciousness coming in through a material, very simple radio, and using it to speak. This is going back to Plato's dualism, that our bodies are the vehicle and the consciousness, the soul is something else. So that whole conversation was very fascinating. And what would you do? Magicians concern themselves with binding spirits to certain things, certain places. How would you like to be a spirit bound to, say, a pearl necklace that has to go through rummage stores, for eternity?
Right.
So what the transhumanists are after, to me, is frightening. Binding your consciousness to a material body, when the reality is that when you're freed from that material body, that's a greater freedom. It's a greater reality.
Well, I mean, but they're talking about almost like the brain is ones and zeros. It's mapping it out and then putting it on some kind of computer. And that may not, and I would strongly suggest that's not you. It might behave in a similar fashion to your personality, but I don't, I think there's a key ghost component missing.
Yeah. I mean, computers themselves are in a way an extension of the human mind in sort of an abstract sort of way, but they're not conscious. But far from it. No, I don't see that. I don't foresee that as likely to happen. AI becoming conscious, and unless some magician comes in and binds a spirit to a computer,
right? That's
a difference.
and it's the whole Star Trek teleporter argument too. Like, is the person on the other side really you? If we could teleport people, are we teleporting their consciousness, or are we creating a likeness that is just similar enough that it doesn't know it's not the original anymore?
Cellularly, that's very fascinating, because that's what our cells are doing, dying off. and regenerating. I mean, we're just a walking cemetery.
Yeah, we're not who we're not who we were 9 years ago.
Yeah, well, there's this statistic, and I'm not sure if it's not just like that, you know, you use only 10% of your brain sort of statistic. I'm not sure if it carries more or less weight than that does, because that statistic is often misunderstood.
Oh, yeah, completely.
But there's this factoid floating around out there that, you know, every 7 years your body is a completely new set of cells.
Right.
I don't know how accurate that is, but conceptually, I mean, it does have a little bit of a ring of truth.
If that is true, on some level. That is true. If that is true in a materialistic sense, technically a person should not be able to be convicted, you know, 9 years later or whatever. They're not the same person.
Well, you know, what I've wondered is people are like, well, that obviously proves that, you know, that the materialist idea of consciousness isn't correct. And like, I have to sort of play a devil's advocate with that and be like, well, couldn't there be some sort of like consciousness water brigade where like one cell hands it off to the next one every year?
Sure, absolutely.
But it is interesting. I am a big fan of the idea that any significantly complex system will in itself tap into this consciousness field that we exist in.
Right.
I have been warming. I remember being very resistant to that idea, but I've warmed up to it quite a good deal since then.
Yeah, I was very resistant to the idea as well. The first time I came across it was in The Holographic Universe by Michael Talbot, and he had talked about these little robots they had created that sort of had autonomy. They could kind of just do what they wanted, and they all kind of developed different personalities, even though they wouldn't have complex programming put into them. But like one would be shy. And then the other one wouldn't be shy, and they'd be like, this is weird. They actually have personalities, even though their programming is basic and the same. It was open enough that they could sort of randomly choose other actions, but the actions were consistent. And they said it's almost like they're slightly conscious. And that bugged the hell out of me, because I'm thinking, well, what does that mean for us then? If that's all consciousness is, it's just, you know, a collection of pieces.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, make the system complex enough it becomes conscious.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hate to keep bringing Plato back into it, but that's, you know,
that's fine.
We're just made up of pieces. The soul is who we are, who our identity is, the seat of reason and rationality. That's what Platonism says we are. These other things, you know, we don't think with our thumb or think with our foot.
But, you know, it's interesting. There is research to suggest that, really fascinating stuff. This is, I'm cribbing from a Mysterious Universe episode here. But, you know, the idea of organ donors receiving some aspect, some snippet of consciousness of their donor.
Seems to
really hold some weight, because, you know, you hear people saying things like, make this decision not with your head, but with your heart.
Right.
Which implies that there's some sort of governing aspect to that. There was an episode, again, on Mysterious Universe that was done a while back where this idea really seemed to hold some degree of weight to it. And that's it's something that I think is going to be favorably evaluated as we proceed forward in the future.
That kind of reminds me of the shaman's dismemberment. And I sort of had an experience where I lost my right eye, not my physical right eye, but, you know, immortality in the past, it's been described as the astral body. That's, you know, soul or whatever you want to call it. What if that body part that was, you know, given to the other person, it's actually has nothing to do with the body part itself, but the little piece of the person's soul that comes with it. That's what's acting on the other person.
Like a sliver of their soul?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it makes sense, because like these are usually not holistic, you know, top to bottom 100% personality changes that these people have. It's just like they just sort of graft onto or replace an aspect of their existing personality whenever they get these transplants.
Right. They develop an interest in something they weren't interested in all about earlier. And then they find out that the person who died had a huge interest in that very subject. That, you know,
yeah, there was this interesting thing where this episode, again, on this Mysterious Universe episode, where there was a guy who was, I believe he was sort of hesitant to get an organ from an African American because he was afraid of, you know, he didn't like that hippity hop and stuff. but what he found was that he actually, after his transplant, he started like humming all these really intricate melodies that he wasn't really aware of. And he found out that they were actually classical melodies, and that the African American kid that he got the whatever organ it was, I believe it was a kidney or something. I can't remember. But this kid was a violin prodigy. Ah. and this guy knew all these, like, he had automatically like taken on all these classical music melodies that he'd never heard before in his life. So yeah, there's a startling amount of compelling research that suggests these sort of things happen.
Plus, it also makes us wonder if information is stored just in every part of us. Again, going back to the holographic idea that every part contains the whole. So when you attach that kidney or that whatever to a new person, they're picking up that information in that part.
It's right. DNA.
Well, more than DNA, actual like storage of information, not just DNA. Like
the soul.
Right, exactly, like a piece of it. Kind of like you were saying, like a piece of it, but stored as, because everything's information. You know, I mean, when we break it right down, our reality is made out of information. So if every part of us contains the whole on some level, holographically, when you share that body part, that part of you is now a part of somebody else, and it mixes and matches.
Hermeneutics! Yep. You know, as above, so below. That's exactly sort of the thing I think that if you look at science as a whole, like, that's the takeaway that nobody ever realizes, but that's really the takeaway.
The hermetic idea that, you know, there are, the universe is infinite, down to, you know, cellular and whatever, how much smaller it gets, quantum, that's all the same patterning. That is really fascinating to think about, and exactly the opposite of this philosophical idea that you know, we are in a finite universe. I would say the hermetic view is that no, this is an infinite universe.
I would say it's an infinite universe. Of course, we can't really understand the concept of infinity.
Is the Benjamin Button jellyfish
immortal?
Sounds like a word salad thing that you just threw out there. Is the Benjamin Button jellyfish snorkel?
So what he's referring to is the jellyfish that doesn't seem to ever die.
Yeah, I'm aware that whenever it gets sufficiently injured, it can sort of revert back to being a larva. Is that right?
Well, I think not only that, it can actually reverse its aging to some degree. Like, it gets to a certain point and it kind of just turns around.
I think I heard a guest of yours, Sarai, bring that up. Kind of makes you... I like to keep returning to this vampire motif and how, you know, theoretically they may be regenerating. And the idea that, like the jellyfish, it's immortal, but it can be killed. Like, a vampire is immortal, but it also can be killed.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it is. I'm not even going to try and say the actual name of this jellyfish. But they say it can live forever, and there's lots of vowels in it. Now officially known as the only immortal creature, the secret to eternal life, as it turns out, not just living a really, really long time, it's about maturity, or rather lack of it. The immortal jellyfish propagate, and then faced with the normal career path of dying, they opt instead to revert to a sexually immature state. Yeah, they kind of jump back to puberty and start over again.
They basically say no to the Kobayashi Maru scenario. Yeah.
Their tentacles retract, their bodies shrink, and they sink to the ocean floor and start the cycle all over again.
Nice.
Vampires, man, kinda...
But the thing is, that's so foreign to what we... Like, I can't even see how you could adapt, even in this age of CRISPR and, you know, and very sophisticated genetic engineering. I don't see how you could adapt that conceptually to human beings. Like,
not directly,
because
no.
the structure and the formation, you know, the biological matrix, I guess is what you'd say, of jellyfish is so relatively simple. I would think that, I mean, yeah, it makes sense that you could sort of, you know, back it up and then, you know,
reformat it,
fast forward. Yeah. I think that we are probably too complex to pull that off. I would think even with some sort of, you know, miraculous genetic engineering feats.
But that is kind of what they're trying to do with the experiments with the mice, is they're trying to teach them to roll back like the genetic aspect, whatever it was, it teaches them to reverse aging.
Oh, well, yeah. But if memory serves, like, I'm specifically speaking to the fact that this jellyfish angle seems like, to me, probably a less promising avenue,
sure,
or if not a dead end. I mean, but I think the jellyfish, I think the mouse de-aging research was sort of revolved around blood, if that's correct, right?
I'm not sure. I didn't actually look at the article.
I think that it did. If I remember hearing about it in sort of the literature, which would be very interesting to me. I mean, you know,
my question is, it would be, they're not going to be mice anymore. Just like the transhumanist movement. If we achieved, something close to immortality of the physical body, I don't think we would be human anymore, and certainly not from a conscious level. The story that would emerge from, you know, it would just change us. The experiences, the continuation of that narrative, and like I keep returning to vampire fiction, how they come totally alienated from humanity because of. You remember the show The Highlander?
Yes.
Oh, that was so awesome.
Yeah.
It's got the headless thing going on. Oh, so cool.
So I found the article, and it says, researchers have found a way to protect a mouse's DNA from the damage that comes with aging, and they're ready to test it in people. And apparently it's running an ad. Stop that. Like, what is that noise? Let's see. They focused on an intriguing compound with anti-aging properties called NAD plus, short for nicotinamide. I'm not even going to try this. It's a big long word. It's been known that younger mice had more of it than older mice. Back in 2013, the researchers found that when they boosted the NAD plus levels in older mice, they looked biologically like much younger animals. So that's what it is.
Hmm.
So if we were to achieve that, who would get it?
That's another interesting question. Because they act like, hey, everyone's going to be, you know, we're gonna be able to solve aging. It's probably just gonna cost $6 or $10 million, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that it would be. Well, you know, I think that because you hear the statistic, right? If the generation that hasn't been born, if the current generation hasn't been born already that will be immortal, then the next generation will be. And you hear the statistic, but the way that technology works in general, and I would assume that this extends to, you know, to medical technology as well. It gets cheaper with every generation, but those first couple of, you know, passes at this technology is extremely cost prohibitive. So I think that if something like that were available, you know, to the public at any given time, it would be available way down the line. And that's a big if, because, you know, I mean, these are the quarters that we travel in. If you think that there is any possibility of an elite controlling things, then you'll never see this. Because who wants 6.5 billion peasants living forever? Nobody.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And maybe they already have it.
Yeah, true. You know, I think of I mentioned this to you, Soraya, the Bohemian Grove, the cremation of care ritual. What would an immortal elite, you know, that would be something they would get up to, is the cremation of their cares. Mm-hmm. You know, the changes, I mean, in consciousness that would happen from being in charge of something like that. Elysium is a good example. This sort of deformed, perverse, sick mindset of those people that were keeping this from the general population. But if we're in charge of it, I would say you can become immortal, traded in for being sterilized. That's how I'd run things.
That's not bad. And you know, we're already faced with an overpopulation issue. If people start living much, much longer, that's certainly going to raise some issues.
Yeah, no, it's true.
I mean, there's already probably too many people on the planet, and then, you know, it's already going up. It's not going to stop just because some people are immortal.
And I think that would really be the death of us. Is
very possible, yeah.
Immortality, because we have to have death to have life. That's my stance on the whole thing. That death is they're like the yin yang.
Do you want to become a gray alien? Because this is how you become a gray alien, you guys. No, but it totally is that narrative, that, you know, the idea that, you know, UFOs are us from the future sort of narrative, right? Oh crap. We're all immortal, but we were all sterilized. So what do? We go back in time and grab some, you know, some sperm and eggs and whip up some babies.
But that's just what I was going to say. Maybe the reverse aging sterilizes us automatically. Maybe nature already has its solution for this.
It makes as much sense as anything else.
I mean, we won't know until, you know, people start being immortal and can't have kids. The problem is having children is so ingrained in our culture that to even suggest that, hey, you don't have to have kids, or you shouldn't be allowed to have kids because there's so too many people, I mean, meets with such a gut reaction from people who just
it's
get
not
very,
ingrained
very
in our
angry.
Culture. It's not in our it's not a cultural thing. It's a biological hardwired thing. I mean, it's not
to some degree, no. But there's plenty of people who don't have that.
Yeah,
but it's not completely biological.
Yeah, but the people who I see have, in my own personal life, so this is completely anecdotal, but the people who I see who have changed their tune about whether or not to have kids, like, they started out as hardline, no, I don't want to have kids, and then, like, just the act of being around kids and thinking about their own, to a degree, their own mortality, their own sort of mm-hmm. life path.
They want to emulate themselves.
Change their opinion. You know, it hasn't been society pressures. It's been their own personal journey.
It's the best way to attain immortality right now is emulate yourself through
yes.
having children.
Yep.
That's what's driving that.
very true. People try to live through their kids. So they force them to kind of try and relive what they did and, you know, not make the mistakes they made. And of course that never works.
Right.
And nature is driving that life. I mean, sex feels good. So it's something that nature wants us to do, which is an interesting question from an animistic point of view. Why is the science headed where it is with this stuff? What forces could be pushing us to what?
But here's the other thing. When we get into the subject of sex, sex, you know, feels good. It's procreative, but it can also be used to alter consciousness. It doesn't have just one use. most people never think of it that way because most people just kind of respond to that blind urge. But tantras and stuff like that and various forms of sex magic can completely alter your consciousness with sex.
Yeah, the little death.
Yes, yeah. Because that the orgasm is the point where your mind separates from, you know, your conscious and unconscious minds kind of meld there for a second. You know, it's almost like a very, very quick nirvana.
Well, that brings me to something, you know, what is esoteric initiation? I've asked a lot of people that question, and the resounding answer I get from people who I believe have actually attained initiation, they say it's death.
Right. It's accepting your own mortality, too. It's like really fully understanding that. That's why most of those initiation rites, you know, you end up in a coffin.
Yeah. Yeah. Golden Dawn, you know, you're at your own funeral.
And well, you know, this is where you bring in the shamanism conversation too. You know, the fact that a lot of these rites of passage have bring you to the brink of death.
Or people become shamans after they have a near-death experience.
Yeah. Exact same concept. Yep.
You know, the headless rite is being talked about a lot of places right now. I did it before I knew what I was doing.
Before it was cool?
I really had no idea. It's a long story, but I started having dream sequences. One of them was I was at my own funeral, and this vile little gnome came and cut my head off and replaced it with the head of a black man. And that was before my big experience that I've told you guys about.
Right.
But that death thing, and then this new life from that death, a new direction, stepping into something new. I don't know what exactly is here other than I look at life and death as that sort of yin yang. They have to be together. So I really do think immortality would be the death of us.
It would definitely change who we are as a species.
Well, yeah, it would change who we are as, like, you know, as a people, like culturally.
Yeah.
I can't imagine, you know, like you think that it's, I think that the knee jerk reaction would be that it would make us less selfish because we have more time. But I think that we would become more selfish. You know, you'll be like, you know, this is all my time for me. I can actually, you know, spend, you know, 75 years learning to play, you know, classical guitar and be better than anybody else at that. I think that's sort of the direction it would go in.
The world would stop. I mean, imagine your great, great grandfather. In this world today, never would have come about if we would still be stuck in your great great grandfather's day if you know, it wasn't for death. You know, like GW says, one funeral at a time is how we progress.
Yeah, and I mean, you think about like the you think about sort of the interpersonal cultural clashes of values that would happen. You know, I would assume that maybe not, but I assume that like certain generations being more progressive would come to complete loggerheads. I mean, you think the country's divided now. Can you imagine if we had, you know, people with even more racist views from the 1930s hanging around? Like, mm-hmm. How much worse would that get, you know?
Yeah.
Of course, the implication is that those people would still have kids and that they wouldn't share that mm-hmm. same culture. But, like, I think that that would be sort of a real problem, too.
With the elitists, we know that they're elitists. They're these cabals that have dynasties that have continued on for generation after generation after generation. Death, in a way, hasn't touched them as it has other. They are able to maintain that dynasty. And those guys are who I like to compare to these vampires. Those dynasties, everybody can tell that they foster decadence, vice, debauchery. You know, that's where their nest is in those type of dynasties. So
now, like, go on.
Yeah, I'm just saying death is very healthy in diminishing that evil.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But the other thing is that we talk about the one death at a time thing. How much of these paradigms do we get stuck in because we're aging, because our brains don't like to take in new information? And if we could reverse aging, so, you know, you hit 30 years old and you could stay at 30 years old forever, essentially, until, you know, you get hit by a car or something. And even then, maybe they can find ways to make our bodies repair themselves quicker.
Guys, they can totally do head transplants these days. Haven't you seen the videos?
But, jeez, you know, would we still have that sort of stubbornness that we get now when some of these people get entrenched and they're not willing to look at new ideas? Or because they're younger, because they're not getting old and cranky, maybe they would be a little more open to some of the new ideas because they're also going to be bored.
I think we would have to come up with, like the school of Platonism was for people in the public arena. We would have to come up with some way of schooling the immortals so that what did you call it? The non-growth, they wouldn't get stuck in that. Because, yeah. I mean, people are very, like the academics, they've done so much work in their field for so long that everybody else is a fool and they couldn't even possibly be open to something. So there would have to be something to corrode that over time, some process that we would have to come up with to deal with stuff like that. I mean, we should have come up with that already.
True, true. But, you know, you got to respect the people who came before you, even if they're making things run slowly.
Mm-hmm. I think what you would probably see would be a bell curve, right? So you'd probably see the curve that we have now, which is going from receptivity to new ideas to the non-receptivity of new ideas. But then you would see, as people pass that like 150 to 200 year mark, a renewed openness to alternative ideas. I say that not only based on just sort of natural phenomena and the way that things tend to go, but like, to me, it seems like you would you would live long enough and see people. I mean, if this isn't a widespread sort of technology, you would see people grow and die and make mistakes, and I think that you would probably adjust to it accordingly. But just based on the way that things in nature tend to go, I think that you would probably see a bell curve of, you know, openness to non-openness and then back to openness, especially as you become resigned to the fact that, like, okay, well, it's time, things are winding down. That would be my sort of alternative take on it.
Throwing out something pretty alternative, writer Ashin Chasson, in his book Gateways Through Light and Shadow, talks to the Archangel Cassiel, which is the Archangel of Saturn, which is pretty much the Grim Reaper. And he says that his job, his office, is to come and end the lives of things that have lost their usefulness.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's a way to look at it, for sure.
Yeah, it sort of makes me wonder, you know, in talking about all this, I am reminded of sort of the last words the second Avengers film, Age of Ultron, where Ultron and the Vision are discussing humanity, and the quote is, you know, a thing isn't beautiful because it lasts. And I wonder if there isn't some sort of inherent, because I mean, that feels like a very true statement to me. I wonder if there isn't some sort of inherent usefulness or inherent beauty that is completely temporally based. And if that's not part of the reason that we are sort of meant to be on this path where things blossom and then fade away. But at the same time, I have to square that against the idea that, you know, if certain quantum theories are to be believed, that, you know, time is basically an illusion in and of itself.
Right.
Where everything is happening simultaneously. So if that's the case, where everything is sort of happening concurrently, if you can take, if you could take a third party perspective of it, then what is the reason for mortality in the first place? What is the reason that we experience these sort of fits and starts throughout time to begin with?
I think it's for evolution. Saturn, it's all about boundaries, borders, death. If that illusion wasn't in place, we would have no way to not be vampires.
And what would happen to the evolution of the species? Because evolution happens through passing on of traits. If nothing else, it would extend that scale infinitely. Because even if some people had children, and you know, because of maybe eventually people die, or you know, because of accidents and diseases and things like that. There wouldn't be, I mean, we don't really see evolution in our lifetime. So how much further back is that going to put evolution moving forward?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I think the transhumanists, a lot of them in the immortality part of that, are thinking that will solve everything. If we can defeat death, that's going to solve everything. But you'd still have human tragedy.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that I think that it would definitely amplify the tragic play. Component of murders and stuff, because like this person, you know, it's like, it's one of the reasons that the elves sacrificing themselves in the Lord of the Rings is so poignant, because they, you know, they have this gift of immortality and they choose to sacrifice it at the, you know, at the altar of whatever cause. So, you know, I think that it would sort of amplify the impact that tragedy has upon us.
Yeah, I mean, check out the Greek myths, the Roman gods, and those pantheons, and how screwed up they are, and the crazy things they get up to.
What would it do to our sanity? That's the other thing. I mean, our brains, our consciousnesses are here for a certain point. And
experience.
What?
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Keep stepping on you. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. Experience like weighs on our conscious. I mean, it's heavy. I mean, the stuff we go through, we're not our soul, you know, we're born all bright eyed and bushy, and our soul, just like our cells, I think it slowly dies and withers. All that experience we go through, it's very weighing on us.
So it's almost like the bitterness is part of the soul atrophying too.
Yeah, it could be.
And it makes sense. It's surprisingly hard as I enter the mid part of my mid thirties. It's surprisingly hard to not be a cynic. I'm amazed at how difficult that process is.
Yeah, I think that was my number one. That's what ended my first marriage. Cynicism. Mm. And I'm just now being able to look back at that and say, that wasn't just a horrible experience. That's something I can learn a lot from and grow from. God, it was awful to go through and almost killed me, but it didn't. I mean, in a way it was a death process in many ways, but, it was an amazing, you know, the alchemical black work from that, something new can happen. It's better, more wise, more heavy too.
Hmm.
Mm.
I'm looking for a quote since we've kind of geeked this episode up pretty nicely. I'm looking for a quote from Babylon 5. In Babylon 5, there was a lot of stuff going on in that series that was fairly deep. And one of the things they had was the first consciousness in the universe, who they called the First One. And he was immortal. One of the quotes, I was looking for the whole quote, but part of the quote goes that he says to the captain of Babylon 5, "Only those whose lives are brief can imagine that love is eternal. You should embrace that remarkable illusion. It may be the greatest gift your race has ever received."
Hmm. Yeah, it sort of makes me wonder if that's not the pot of gold at the end of this rainbow, is the fact that, like, this thing that we view as a curse. Oh, I can't believe that we, you know, only have so many years to live and then we die. Maybe that's a gift. Like, maybe that's the point. Maybe that's a mercy. Mm-hmm. I think that gets overlooked a lot.
I found the whole quote. It says, well, a bigger chunk of the quote: "To live on as we have is to leave behind joy and love and companionship, because we know it to be transitory of the moment. We know it will only turn to ash. Only those whose lives are brief can imagine that love is eternal. You should embrace that remarkable illusion."
That's great.
Yeah. That was a very well-written show.
It's a bit cynical. It reminds me of a philosopher. I can't think of his name right now. He was an atheist, but he thought the idea of God in itself, or not necessarily God, the idea of the infinite was beautiful in itself and worthwhile. It reminds me very much of him.
Hmm. And like I said earlier, the infinite's one of those things we simply can't perceive. I mean, no matter how we look at our existence here, like, when you really, really logically think about it, we shouldn't be here. There shouldn't be existence. And, you know, when you look at the religious idea that, you know, doesn't matter what religion, but some deity created us. Okay, well, where did the deity come from? And then you look at the scientific idea and it's like, well, everything was compressed into a singularity and it exploded. Okay, well, where did the singularity come from?
Yeah, the old Terrence McKenna chestnut: give us one good miracle and we can explain the rest. Yeah.
And I mean, and they'll say, well, you know, everything was one and it's singular and, you know, there was no time. So there was no before. Time didn't happen until it exploded, but it's still, where did it come from? You deal with it no matter what. You deal with that concept, and I don't think there's any way for our brains at this point to conceive of that, to really fully understand existence in any way, shape, or form. Because even if we believe, okay, we're living in a virtual reality, well, that means there's another reality out there, and where did that one come from?
Yeah, exactly. That's, I think, points to the transcendency of all of this. Infinite is a sense we have that we can't have any sense of.
Yeah.
Well, to me, like, the idea of, since we're sort of touching on that a little bit, the Matrix sort of concept, to me, the reason that fails is for the same reason that I have a disdain for panspermia, is because it's just kicking this materialist can down the road. It's saying, well, we don't have to deal with this right now because it's something bigger than this. You know, we don't have to deal with where life came from on Earth because it came from somewhere else. And we'll deal with that when we get to that planet, right? Well, we don't have to deal with what reality is because it's all a simulation. So we'll deal with that when we figure out what this is. And it's just, it's materialist apologetics for me, you know?
What was I going to say? Oh, and one of the comments I was going to make about when I said that having kids is cultural, I've known a number of people who have had kids simply because they had so much pressure from their families to have kids, and they themselves really didn't want to have kids.
Mm. Yeah, I'll be honest with you. After having a pretty rough experience with a dog that my wife and I got, which we can talk about later, after sort of dealing with that, you know,
is it still alive?
It's still alive. The poor thing. We got her. So okay, well, might as well hash this out. Whatever. It's where the road go. We're good. So like, poor thing. We got her a thunder shirt and a pheromone collar. Talked to a behavioralist. She was on. Xanax and Prozac. Oh, like human level prescriptions. Yeah. And she still, every time like it would be overcast, she'd go crazy and pee everywhere. So we're just like, it's one of those things. It was like breaking up with somebody who's mentally unstable. It's like, look, you're a great person. I love you. Someone will help you. That's not me. So we ended up taking her back to the charity that we got her from. They're like, don't worry. We have a really good placement rate. Yeah. It sucks really bad. Cause it was, you know, it was 2 months with this dog and I still have a real soft spot for her, but it was just one of those things where, again, like this is fine in the winter months when we can predict when storms are going to happen. But what happens when we're both out of the house and there's a summer thunderstorm? Because in the South, you know, you can have two or three thunderstorms in the middle of the day that just happen of their own accord. And she was at one point, she actually, during a thunderstorm, pushed her way out of the cage that we had her in. I'm just terrified she's going to hurt herself. So she needs somebody who can like be with her all the time. Anyway, that's having said that, like this was my wife's and I in a great experiment. Like how are we going to do with a kid? We're like, we didn't just
they pee and poo everywhere for years.
Yeah. Right. but you know, I think there is, I'm not saying that I want to have kids just because I believe it will make me a better person, but everyone that I've talked to who has a kid, in my own personal circle believes that it has made them a better person. And I think for me, that's part of what I was put on earth to do is to think of something else more highly than I do myself, to place the well-being, the happiness of something else other than myself, above myself.
I don't think you need a kid necessarily to do that.
Though. I don't think you do either. But
you know, your books are your children.
I was thinking more of his wife, but all right. Books, wife.
Fair enough. My wife.
Our work in many ways is our child and how it affects other people.
But here's the thing, man. Nobody ever sits on their nobody's ever quoted on their deathbed as saying, I wish I'd written another book about UFOs, but I don't know.
There might've been someone. I had this idea. I'm dead.
Like if you look at the sort of, there are certain projects out there that have recorded what people's last words are. And they tend to be stuff like, I wish I'd spent more time with person XYZ. Sure. I wish I had traveled. So these are the things I'm trying to sort of prioritize.
They wish, you know, they had lived their life more.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like more money is never the thing that they say. No. You know? The prioritization of that maybe, but more. Well, you know. So
the thing is, money. The value of money comes down to being able to live your life like you want to. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, most of us scrape by. So we have we're very limited in what we can do. We can't just say, hey, you know, Machu Picchu looks nice.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll fly off to that next month. You know, I mean, we don't have those options. So we can lay on our deathbed and say, oh, I wish I traveled more, but you need that money to do it. And it's that catch 22 that getting that money,
yeah,
especially in at least the United States at this point, you know, the economy is not great. Prices keep going up. Pay does not go up. So you have this cycle where people just can't get ahead. You're perpetually behind on everything. So you don't have that money to just go do stuff. So it may not be that you're on your deathbed going, I wish I had more money. You're saying, I wish I could have done all these other things, but to do those other things, you would have needed more money.
Right.
My dilemma is, what is the magician who conjured demons to get money to live his life going to be saying on his deathbed?
Oh, crap. What happens now?
Yeah.
Of course, it all depends on what you mean by demons. I was assuming you meant the sort of Mephistopheles sort of idea.
Yeah. The guys who can get your money are the sublunary guys, the guys who are closest to this Earth realm, in my opinion, anyway, tend to be the scarier ones.
The again, to throw to a television show, and not even a good one, Sleepy Hollow, the current season. I don't know why I'm watching it, so don't ask, because it's not good. But they have this guy who basically made a deal with the devil to become rich and powerful. And he realizes, oh, they're going to have my soul when I die. So now he's seeking immortality. And that's, if nothing else, that idea is actually kind of amusing to me. It's kind of like he's basically looking for a way to cheat.
Yeah, I think I watched the first couple of seasons of that. It has a headless motif, right?
Yeah, yeah, it has the whole headless horseman thing going on. I mean, it's not well written. For some reason, it entertains me, so I watch it.
I think there was even a shot in the first season of The Key of Solomon in one of the scenes.
Oh, yeah, they throw all kinds of stuff pretty much at random into the whole series.
Hmm.
It's one of the few things that I literally will say, this is not good, but I'm going to watch it anyway, and I can't really tell you why.
Yeah, it was kind of fun for me to watch.
It reminds me, Soraya, I remember, I think we said this off air to me, the first time we had our conversation, that 6 hour long conversation with Red and everybody. But I come back to it all the time, which is this idea that there are things that are bad that you like and things that are bad that you don't like. And there are things that are good that you like and things that are good that you don't like. And the key to being like an actual connoisseur of these things is realizing where that difference is, you know. And
right.
I keep on coming back to that. So yeah, don't feel ashamed for liking the show.
I'm not even sure if I like it. That's the worst part. It's just it entertains me. I like I don't know. Like, I really like The Expanse, and I really like The Expanse because The Expanse is this deep space opera, which is getting horrible ratings, but did get renewed at least. That deals with the concept of alien life coming into our solar system. And it's really freaking good. The other one that really surprised me that was really interesting is Legion.
Right, I've heard really good things about that.
I mean, just for concepts of reality, I mean, I didn't know what it was, and then I found out, oh, it's kind of in the X-Men universe, and I went, oh, so it's a superhero type of mutant type of thing. And it is, but it's not, because it's very deep. And they deal with different concepts of reality. I mean, the main character keeps going back and forth of what's real. Is this real? Is what I'm experiencing now real? What is real? You know?
It's interesting.
And I was really surprised at how excellent it was. And of course, it only went like 10 episodes and then it's done, but renewed.
Did you guys see Logan?
No.
Not yet.
Oh, well, I better not say anything about it then, but... Yeah, on the death motif, and it's it was depressing for me.
I've heard great things about it in terms of being really introspective and stuff. But I've heard that it's not a pick me up. No, it's
depressing. Go ahead.
And I do think that part of the problem with living forever is that we would become bored. I mean, and would that drive us to new heights? Would that be the thing that sends us out into space, especially, you know, is it going to take 100 years to get there? Well, I got it. Sure. Let's just go, you know?
I think the first couple of thousand years would be spent in just straight up debauchery. And we'd eventually hit the bottom and say, okay, what else can we do here? And, I think this idea, you know, in life, or if you're immortal, kind of parsing out your passions, what you enjoy, do something fun a couple of weeks. Don't like submerge yourself in just fun stuff all the time. You'll kill it. You know, you'll kill all the joy out of it.
Sure.
Yeah. It would be like a 4 year long bender of everybody who gets this new power. Right. And then you'd be like, oh, well, what else is left? I mean, yeah, that's an interesting take, is that like we would basically exhaust the pleasures of the flesh and would be forced to turn to spirituality.
Well, but what would happen to spirituality with a infinite lifespan, you know?
We'd probably yearn for it, right? We'd probably yearn for the afterlife more than we do now, right?
I don't think the spirits would allow this it's happened. That's my point of view. But,
no, that's a completely valid interpretation. That's for sure.
I don't know. I mean, because if you consider there's if you accept the idea that there's more than one part of us, there's a higher self and a, you know, in our conscious self and so on and so forth, is it going to erode that connection to the higher self? I mean, maybe part of why we die is to get back that connection. And if we don't have that connection because we're living 700 or 800 years, again, I think that leads possibly to madness, to psychopathy, and who knows what else.
Yeah. Take a look at the Rothschild
book. Well, and I think it's interesting. We're talking about all this immortality, but it's interesting that, you know, Rockefeller just died
after sixth
or eighth heart transplant or something, right?
So they say. Yeah, maybe they've reversed his aging, and now we're going to have a young Rockefeller.
He's now in the body of, I don't know, insert pop culture figure here.
Some young hot blonde pop singer he's reincarnated into.
All right. Well, I think we've covered this decently. I think it's something we can probably come back to at some point. But I think for now we can leave it there and let some people chime in and see what other people think about the concept. So, you know, let us know. What do you think? Do you think immortality would be a good or a bad thing? And what would the consequences be? And let you guys tell people where they can get a hold of you. Aaron?
Yeah, I'm at charmthewater.com. Charm the Water Facebook page, Charm the Water Twitter, whatever your favorite social media is, and podcast feeder. We're all over the place.
Okay, and Josh?
JoshuaCutchin.com, and here on Where Did the Road Go, hopefully on a more consistent basis than I have been lately. JoshuaGutchin.com is sort of the hub for all my stuff.
All right, and we're going to take you out tonight with a band called Inviolate. They are from Atlanta, Georgia, and they have a new album they're working on, but this comes off their previous one. This is the title track. It's called Feast of Ashes.
I live whole but hollow. One touch can crumble me down. Your eyes so like my own heart, my dreaming mind, and I can't sleep now. Feel like I dance on razors. Thought of you lacerates my core. Is this atonement for things I never knew I'd ever done before? But no mistake, I hate what I've become.
you've spoken. One ray can ward away the dark. So will you take my hand, and we'll no longer need.